Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and thanks for listening to the New Books in Jewish Studies podcast. I'm David Gottlieb. My guest today is Professor Yuval Harari, professor in the Department of Jewish Thought and head of the Program of Folklore Studies at Ben-Gurion University. Professor Harari is the author of Jewish Magic Before the Rise of Kabbalah, recently revised and published in English translation by Wayne State University Press. Professor Harari's work opens new vistas not only on the history of the practice of magic throughout Jewish cultures, but on the variety and the syncretistic depth of such practices. Professor Harari's work thus challenges perceptions and categorizations of what Jewish magic is and what its place in the Judaism of late antiquity was. It promises to facilitate a reappraisal of the performative practices and the beliefs and rituals on which Jewish life as we know it was founded. Professor Harari's work carefully and systematically examines a wide variety of Jewish texts and artifacts and reveals the extent to which the practice of magic is woven into Jewish ritual thought and culture from late antiquity through and beyond the Middle Ages. Professor Harari, thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure for me, and I think I should leave now, because after all these beautiful words, what else can
no,
I
no.
say? I mean,
we're just getting started, but thank you. I just want to start out by asking you how you became interested in the study of Jewish magic and how that became the focus of your research.
Well, that's a question that takes me back ago to the time when I was a student at the Hebrew University and I did my MA studies, and I looked for a subject for my thesis. And then Moshe Idel referred me to a manuscript in which I could find a treatise called The Sword of Moses. And I was fascinated by this treatise. This is how it all began, because, you know, some 80 years before that, Moses Gaster published a version of this text, but I realized very soon that I had at hand a much earlier manuscript that I could do better with, and that's what I did. I mean, and that's how it started. Then during my PhD studies, I decided to go into the study of Jewish magic as culture in late antiquity, Yeah.
Very good. So, and this, as I understand it, is a revised and updated version of the book. In other words, it's produced in English translation, but in the process of working on the translation, you also revised and to a certain extent expanded the text. Could you talk a little bit about what you learned in the course of working on this new edition, or what new research surfaced about the practice and history of Jewish magic?
And the English translation, what I had to do was to mainly to update the apparatus and to take into account the book of my dear friend and colleague Gideon Bohak, who has already published in, I think, 2008, his book on ancient Jewish magic, A History. Mm-hmm. And it was unthought of that I'll publish my book in English and will not take into consideration his thoughts.
Uh-huh.
This is, I mean, one of the most outstanding works on Jewish magic in antiquity, and I had to do that. I had to take into account other scholars. I mean, the study of Jewish magic is growing,
yes,
very fast.
Right, and it's a quickly expanding field.
Yeah, yeah, and there are many, many new articles and studies that are being published. And, you know, one has to take care of all of that. But
right,
there's not so many, I mean, there's no real difference in my attitude or in the main thesis of my book, in Hebrew and English.
And you discuss also the history of the study of magic, and
right,
I want to talk a little bit about that with you, and specifically about whether we are still, most of us, of course, not the scholars in this field like yourself, but whether broadly speaking, we're still heirs and in some way still hostages to the sort of evolutionist intellectual theory of magic propounded by Fraser and Tyler, among others. That is to say that that society as a whole progresses from superstition to religion to science. Are we still in some sense under sway to that view of magic, especially in Jewish tradition?
I'm not sure about it in general, because if you take one step further, then you come to contemporary religiosity or spiritual movements that take magic very deeply into consideration. So, mm-hmm, in a way, we are beyond this point of disenchantment of the world, as Weber put it.
And we're sort of moving toward the re-enchantment of the world.
Yeah, yeah, we are there, mm-hmm, already.
It's interesting say that, because you say in your epilogue, at the very end of the book, you say, and I quote, "The time seems ripe for abandoning the tendency to organize Jewish forms of life on the truth axis we have inherited, naturally and almost unwittingly, from both the religious and learned elites." And that's a very interesting observation. I wonder how... if you can talk a little bit about that observation and how specifically your study of magic informed that observation.
Well, I'm very glad you mentioned this epilogue, because this is the only place in the book where I'm a bit programmatic. I think that we really inherited a image of what Judaism is and what it has already been in its very true nature, and what it actually should be for eternity. And
mm-hmm,
and life is much broader. I mean, there were many kinds of Jews during history. There were many underground or on the ground streams of belief and practices that were not part of normative in rabbinical terms, normative Judaism in rabbinical terms. Part of it was rabbinic in itself, but was was stereotyped as non-normative or illegitimate. And
right,
you know, I'm not here to judge whether what Judaism truly is. What I wanted to do is to say that there are other types of behaviors and other types of Judaism that must be put on the table and take their place within the broad culture of historical Judaism.
Right. And your research seems to suggest that these practices were not only widespread in Judaism in late antiquity, in the rabbinic era and beyond, but that what we have come to think of as normative Judaism, that is rabbinic Judaism, was deeply familiar with these practices, even if it cast a cold eye upon them. Isn't that so?
Yeah, I think so. But it depends on how we define magic, or kishuf in Hebrew. And, you know, we are always part of a language game, and terms are used for Do you say demarcating?
Demarcating,
or
yes, right.
Yeah, people or groups and for... So yes, rabbinic elites were familiar with what we may call kishuv practices or magic practices. It was part of rabbinical narratives. There are narratives about rabbis who perform acts that actually look like what they would term as kishuv, as non-legitimate magic, had it been done by others. But and we see it in narratives in the Talmud and elsewhere. They are evidence of literate magic in antiquity, in magic plates by people who were familiar with the scripture and with the liturgical practices of that time, and with the, and they could read and write. And they served people, so they were not at the margin of society. And I think that these practices took place in daily life in Judaism all along the history. There were very few people like Maimonides or Leibovich and others. I mean, there were others that actually rejected it from the outset.
Yes.
But
yeah.
Mostly it was part of daily life, and we see it also in medieval and early modern manuscripts of books of recipes. You know, there are dozens and hundreds of books of magic recipes written in Hebrew and Aramaic, and
yes,
and it's all over.
And I want to get back to asking you about that, but because you brought up, because we have been discussing the issue of rabbinic familiarity with magic.
Yep.
And how frequently it occurs in the Talmud, I want to read this passage from Tractate Sanhedrin that you include in the book, and just have a couple of questions about how you react to it and how it depicts the rabbinic familiarity with magic. So here's that portion which you quote in the book. It's about Rabbi Yanai. Yanai came to an inn. He said to them, "Give me water to drink." They brought him shatita, a kind of porridge. He saw that the innkeeper's lips were moving. He spilled some of the drink, which turned into scorpions. He said to them, "I have drunk of yours, you too drink of mine." He gave her to drink, and she turned into an ass. He rode on her to the market. Her friend came and broke the spell. He was seen riding a woman in the market. I mean, that is just an extraordinary depiction of how the rabbis could be seen as understanding and turning magic against itself. But it's interesting, too, because you point out in your book that one of the points of magic was to challenge and in a way to reinvigorate religion. Can you talk more about that?
In the connection to the story?
Well, so let's begin with the story. I mean, does the story show a kind of rabbinic familiarity with religion and an ability to sort of use it against itself?
From my point of view, everybody in antiquity was threatened by the opportunity that someone would perform hostile magic against.
Right. So this was a daily problem, right? A daily fear.
I think so. This was a daily problem, and you know, we find in Mesopotamia, we find what we call Qibla bowls that were made in order to turn hostile magic or harmful magic back on the one who sent them or mm-hmm. send them.
Mm-hmm.
So was threatened by the and so if one found himself sitting in an inn and he could see someone talking on the shatita, and there was a possibility that something very bad was going to happen, so
right.
He could subvert it, and he could first, he could check it and uncover the spell. Mm-hmm. Then he could face them and overcome the witch in the inn. So in a way, it's a very concise story that tells you both about the threat of women as witches.
Yeah.
And with issue which I deal at length in my book, and then about the power of the rabbis to overcome other agents of ritual power, be them Gentiles or women or whoever they are, they were.
This raises two really other interesting questions that I wanted to ask you about, and that your answer just now brought up. And one is is how the rabbis' reaction to magic seems, at least in terms of their reaction to sorcery, to be sort of founded in a profound fear of female sexual power, and that sorcery is intimately tied to that power. Is that, am I getting that right?
I think so. I think that the accusation, we should divide between the doing the sorcery itself, the culture of performing sorcery, and the political accusation of the other in doing so. And I think that blaming women for doing sorcery was not part of what really happened in life, and I'll say a word about it in a moment, but a part of male struggle, again, it's a part of gender struggle between men and women, in which the rabbis who control wish to control their society try to push away or to handle the threatening power of the female gender. And by stereotyping their power as magic, which means it's dangerous, it's illegitimate, it comes from a sinful source, so it opposites the spiritual power of the rabbis.
Very
so it's some mundane power that comes from illegitimate sources and employed by women, which should be drawn to the back of the stage, right? Now, right now, I would like to say that it's not that women did not at all perform magic in antiquity, because if I say so, I myself would be the one who would belittle their ability to take place in their society, because I believe that everybody was able to perform magic in antiquity, and why not women? I mean, men and women as well took part, either themselves or through agents, through professional agents, in this kind of pre-industrial technology or something like that. I mean, it's a kind of technology that was a very rational one if you look into its gaps, based on assumptions that we may not accept concerning the way the world is run.
And it's so fascinating because it seems that these practices, in terms of what's been found in archaeological sites and in the Cairo Geniza, were very common.
Yes, they were common. They were common. I mean, we find they were common. They are still common. I mean, during the last years, I've been doing a field work in Israel. There are still people who write amulets today and magic plates today in Israel. They're not, mainstream doctors, of course, but there are still people who are who do use these practices, and people come to them and pay money and sit for hours at the entrance of their atelier or whatever, have their service. And it happened also in antiquity. We have a lot of evidence, I mean, a broad evidence for that. We have more than 1,500 magic balls from Mesopotamia, from all over Mesopotamia, from the 5th to the 7th century, mainly for exercising purposes. We have hundreds or even more of that, thousands of fragments, magic fragments from the Cairo Geniza. We know of two large books of magic, Sefer Harazim, the Book of Mysteries, and Harba de Moshe, the Sword of Moses, from the first millennium. I mean, there's broad evidence concerning what we call the insider evidence, the evidence left for next generations by the very activity of magic, not evidence which is found in sources which are not are non-magical and talk about magic from the outside.
Right.
I mean, we have the evidence of what really was carried out.
I think, and this is very interesting, and you raised a point that I think is a main theme in your book, and that is the distinction between insider, what you call insider and outsider magic. And I understand that to mean, you know, the insider magic is the primary source that supply concrete evidence of magic culture from a practical and performative perspective, and the outsider magic are the sources that expressed awareness of that, but that don't approach it from a practical point of view. Is that a correct depiction of your distinction? And how is the distinction reflected in the amulets, in the bowls, and the other artifacts, and the texts that you've examined?
Yeah, it is a correct distinction, but not between insider and outsider magic, but between insider and outsider sources. Because until recently, let's say more or less 30 or 40 years ago, the main sources we used to have were outsider sources, writings of the rabbis, the Bible, the Second Temple period literature, rabbinical writings, philosophical writings, and so on and so forth. But we didn't, so all we knew about magic or the culture magic of the Jews of that time was through the lens or the hostile lens of the elites. And these are political writings in a way because they have an agenda. But now we have lots and lots of artifacts and writings that reflect the practical activity, either the interest in doing what we may call magic acts, or the evidence of doing it per se. I mean the what I call performative artifacts, the artifacts that were prepared for doing something in the world. So we have the evidence itself, and I think that, and this is what I do in my book, I think that we have to change places. We first have to describe Jewish magic according to its own evidence. And then once we understand that, we can go back to the outsider evidence and have a second look at it and see how political it is.
Very interesting.
And I really analyzed the outsider evidence from a political, social political point of view.
And it seems, in reading your book, one of the things that comes over a reader is an awareness of how much even what we would call normative Jewish religious practice has magical elements in it. One can point to the Kaparot ceremony at Yom Kippur, or Mezuzah, or even Tefillin to a certain extent, have aspects of amulet or warding off certain spirits and attracting others. So has your research helped shed light for you, as it did for me, on how much magic or magic-like practices were adapted by Rabbinic Judaism so that they were deprived of their negative or scary connotation?
So it's first of all, most a question of language game. I mean, and it's a question of the emic-etic attitude, because from the emic point of view, from the point of view of the society itself, mezuzah is, of course, not a magical artifact. Even though, from the ethic point of view, from my point of view, from the point of view of the one who, or the researcher, or the one who looks at it from the outside, it doesn't really matter whether it is a normative, commanded a part of the ritual behavior of the society, or whether it's a non-normative artifact. It doesn't really matter whether a person expressed an adjuration, a piece of a magic formula of adjuration, mm-hmm. or whether 10 people goes together to a certain holy place and say whatever they say in order to bring rain on earth. I mean, from the outsider point of view, there's no such a huge difference between what we may call religion and we may call magic. There's a huge gap between them from the emic point of view, from the point of view of the society itself. And like I learned it from Jacob Neusner, who wrote in one of his article that from our point of view, the rabbis of the Babylonian rabbis they could have been approached as lawyer magicians, but their students probably or definitely would not think of them as magicians, but as holy men, and so on and so forth. But it's in a way, it's a question of terms. But
it is a question of terms, but in a way, it's also a question of epistemology too, right? Because magic is a categorization that we make that may not translate well to the actual time in which these practices existed.
Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there were scholars who regarding Hellenistic magic or the study of religion in general suggested to give up the use of the term magic mm-hmm. from the academic discourse on this ritual behavior of people or peoples. So I don't think so, because I think we are caught in our language game. We don't have a dictionary definition of magic even today. But I follow Wittgenstein in this quest.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that you and I know more or less how to use the term magic in a way that we can converse about it.
Yes.
So even though we might not share the same dictionary definition of the term, we are part of a language game that enable us to talk about it. We are not part of the language game of the terms like kishuf and kashpanut in late antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
But we can go and see. What is there in those texts, the insider texts, that we, from our standing point, call magical texts, and then try to understand why do we identify them as magical texts?
Right.
And once we understand that, we have a linguistic basic for building the corpus of the insider evidence. And once we have that, we can see what the ideas and the beliefs and the practices within this inside the corpus are,
uh-huh.
and then we can have a broad understanding of what magic was for them at that period. But we must start with our language game.
Yes.
So I don't think there is a reason to throw away this term. We can use it.
Yeah.
You know, it's just more or less we know what we mean by it.
Right. I wanted to ask you also about two related subjects, really, and these are practices that are mentioned in biblical and rabbinic text, one of which I'm aware of you making a connection to with magic, and another I'm not sure about. I may just have missed it in my reading of the book. But the first is prophecy. There seems to be a strong link between prophecy and esoteric knowledge. Obviously, the rabbis decreed the end of prophecy after the destruction of the Second Temple, but there is still esoteric knowledge and practice, it seems, that involves a kind of divination that approaches prophecy. Is that correct? And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. I mean, you're right that prophecy ceased to exist, according to the rabbis, before their time, but they say that fools and children, I mean, prophecy was given to fools and children.
Right.
And people usually understand that in a kind of a derogative notion. I mean, mm-hmm. that whoever declares himself to be a prophet is like a kid or a fool.
Yeah.
But as I try to show in my book, I think that fools and children were a kind of agent of divination in antiquity. Fools because they maybe because they used to sleep in the graves, in graveyards.
Uh-huh.
And it said in the rabbinic, I mean, I try to put together some sources from rabbinic literature in order to show that.
Yeah.
And about kids, we know it for sure. It's, you know, give me a verse, a biblical verse. I mean, rabbis and others go to kids and ask them for biblical verses, and they, according to these verses, they, it's like a oral bibliomancy, you know.
Yes.
Go to a kid who is a oral book and ask for a whatever verse that comes to his mind, and they study something from this verse. So it's a kind of kids as agents of divination.
Really.
So there were no prophets anymore, and you know, the rabbis also say that rabbis are better than prophets. Are better than prophets, and they themselves take them their place.
Yeah.
And yes, prophecy and divination are two sides of the same phenomena.
And the other practice I wanted to ask you about, which of course defined pre-Judaic Israelite practice for millennia, is the practice of sacrifice. Can you talk a little bit about the connection that you see, if you do, between the certain magical practices and the practice of ritual sacrifice?
Yeah, only, I mean, it's, I think it's too, if we take all these ritual practices together, put them together, it goes beyond the way that I described the basis for my study, because I started with texts with certain linguistics elements within them, but uh-huh. Now you go further and further, but it's okay.
Yeah.
What I would like, if I may, what I would like to say is that ritual and sacrifice is part of magical practices. It's also part of magical practices.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, they are small and very easy to get animals that are sacrificed in magical practices. But this goes on. It disappears in the normative ritual of Judaism, but it still goes on
mm-hmm.
within the minor, if we may say so. Minor sacrifice are do exist in magic rituals, mainly at, you know, it increases in Middle Ages and early modern books of recipes. We find more and more reasons for and acts of sacrifice of all kinds of poor animals.
Yeah.
That were killed in very awful ways.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Okay.
Like that. Yeah.
One final question, because somehow our time has already flown by, that I'm asking because you mentioned it and it piqued my curiosity really. From a personal perspective, is that the magical practices that you see today in contemporary Israel, are there clear connections and a clear continuity between those practices and what you have been studying from millennia past?
In some cases, in manuscripts, in magic manuscripts, you can follow a formula from antiquity to modern printed books.
Wow.
So in some cases you do find it.
Mm-hmm.
In other cases, like in the cases of magic plates, white plates, the tassa,
mm-hmm.
There's no a direct connection, but the very use of a vessel on which one writes adjurations and then uses it for magic or ritual purposes. That start in antiquity, then we find it in the Middle Ages in the Muslim culture, and then we find it in other ways, in other manifestations, in Jewish communities in the Arab lands, and then it immigrates to Israel with those Jews who came to Israel in the 50s and 60s, and and it's still practiced today. So in a way, you may find continuity and changes, what folklorists may call oikotypes of the same type of activity that goes from antiquity to our day. It's not that magic is should be done strictly according to the scripted procedure procedure in the writings, because when we meet people, when I meet people and I talk to them, I understand that there's a lot of place for creativity, personal creativity. A person who works according to a book of magic may take part of the instructions and combine them with instructions for other places and create something new in order to achieve something. But there is a line of continuity from pre-Kabbalah magic tradition to what was called practical Kabbalah, and to even to magic in our day.
Very interesting. My great pleasure speaking with you. The book is fascinating. The book is Jewish Magic Before the Rise of Kabbalah, published by Wayne State University Press. And my guest has been the author, Yuval Harari, professor in the Department of Jewish Thought at Ben-Gurion University. Professor Harari, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, David.